I'm just going to dive right into my lecture by giving you a sense of what I plan to do for the next 45 minutes or so. And the lecture is divided into roughly three parts. In the first part of the talk, I will set up for you major debates around what we think of as a very crucial analytic in Asian America and Asia today, which is the topic of success. What does success mean for Asian Americans and Asians across the globe? In the second part of the talk, I situate this notion of success within transnational lenses. How do we think about it on a transnational level? And then in the final part of the talk, I will provide some preliminary data from this new book project. And as Anthony said, this is the first time that I'm presenting from this new book project. And so I'm eager to hear your thoughts and your comments, and please be brutal with them. But keep in mind that it is my first time, and I'm sort of going through the data. And so what I'm presenting to you today is really fresh, green ideas. So let me begin by talking about a book that is actually not an academic book that some of you may know. Does anybody know this book? Nobody. Oh, this book is really a fantastic book, but the story behind it is quite intriguing. And it's written by this married couple, Christy Shin and Bryce Lung. And I have been following them for quite a long time, probably for about 3 years. And the fascinating thing about them as a couple is that they retired at the age of 31. With about $2 million. And I got tenure at the age of 31. And as soon as I got tenure, it was the first time that I made contributions towards my retirement. And so these people retired at the age of 31, which is kind of, you know, crazy. You don't hear that very often. But they are part of, as many of you probably know, part of this movement called the FIRE movement, which stands for Financial Independence Retire Early. And it involves sort of saving a lot of your income and investing it and living frugally so that you don't have to sell your soul to capitalism. And the couple, they're really adorable. They're all over YouTube. They have their own YouTube channel. They have a very extensive website. They have been interviewed by many outlets and many TV channels, many media, because of this fantastic story about them retiring at the age of 31 with $2 million+. And in the book, they document how they did this. And as I said, they are really funny and adorable. And Christy is quite gregarious, much more than her husband, who's kind of shy. And in the interviews, he's often in the background, and she's the one speaking. So their story, very briefly, is that they actually are Canadians. They grew up in Toronto. They are immigrants, children of poor immigrants who worked really hard, and they went to university in Toronto, where they majored in computer science, became computer engineers for 9 years. Their career lasted for 9 years, and then retired. And they didn't figure out that they would retire early until about year two of their job, when they realized that if they did it right, they could retire very early. And in this book, what they do is they map out how you can do it. And it's actually really interesting, especially for you younger people who would like to retire early. And I actually learned quite a few things about it. As I said, I followed them for many years and have taken some tips from them. So I've been very, very fascinated with them, given their life story. And now they're, I think, 34. But I was really intrigued in one particular interview, and this is why I'm using them as an example to sort of launch this lecture. In one particular interview with them, I think it was on CBS Morning News or something like that, the interviewer asked them, what is the number one advice you would give to young people if they wanted to do what you do? You know, work hard and save money. And of course, Christy is the first person to answer. She's like, you know, work really hard, you know, save your money. And most of all, no matter what you do, don't major in shit like sociology. You know, and of course, I majored in sociology all the way through. You know, I majored in sociology as an undergraduate. I majored in sociology as a grad. I have a PhD in sociology. I'm a sociology professor. You know, this is kind of funny, but it's really a viewpoint that is shared by many Asian Americans. Americans, and of course many people in Asia, right? You must choose the right field of study for the right career so that you can be financially lucrative. And so their story is really an important story to think about as we sort of debate what success means to different groups in Asia and Asian America. And their quote here really summarizes their view on money. This is actually Christie's point. She goes, "Money is the most important thing. Money is worth sacrificing for. Money is even worth bleeding for." So what I want to do today is I will report to you in a very preliminary way my recent multi-sided longitudinal study about how the post-war generation of the Vietnamese diaspora understand success in their lives and point to how these understandings have produced different measurements of worth, criteria of exclusion, distancing behavior, and ultimately notions of superiority. If you think about the story of Christie and Bryce, they represent, I would say, a dominant view of success in Asia America. And I would talk about some studies that have documented this. And people like them generally use what we call socioeconomic boundaries to separate themselves from other people. Part of what we think of as symbolic boundaries within the literature in sociology, which I'll talk more about later in the talk. And people who draw socioeconomic boundaries between them and other people tend to emphasize things like ambition, financial success, material accumulation as what they think of as a successful person, right? In contrast, people sometimes also draw what we call cultural boundaries. And these people tend to emphasize in their lives things like education, intelligence, mannerisms, taste, and command of high culture, right? And I would say that Christie and Bryce tend to emphasize the first socioeconomic boundaries over the second, cultural boundaries. A third type of boundaries that people often draw is also what we think of as moral boundaries. And these are the people who tend to separate themselves from other people on the basis of things like honesty, being nice and kind, personal integrity, and consideration of others. And of course, in social life, we many of us, depending on the stages of life, depending on the people we compare ourselves to, maybe emphasize one of these boundaries over the other. But we all, in general, probably, if we had to be honest, use one of these boundaries as the key measurement of how we see other people and how we categorize people according to our mental maps of how we separate ourselves from other people, and sometimes, but not always, how we determine whether we are better than other people. And so my talk is really, or my new book, tries to unravel this phenomenon for the Vietnamese diaspora by taking the notion of success on a transnational level. In the larger project, I focus on a range of economic and educational groups, but in this talk, I showcase the views of two very specific groups in the diaspora. The first group are Vietnamese Americans. I will occasionally refer to them as migrants, but most of the time I will call them Vietnamese Americans, who make regular trips back to the homeland. So these are people who have returned at least 5 times in the past 10 years. Many of them have businesses there. Many of them have families back. So the transnational traversing between the United States and to the homeland is quite regular. They also tend to be people who work in jobs for the sole purpose of making money, as opposed to jobs for which they derive personal interest, passion, or a sense of intrinsic satisfaction from helping society. Some of these respondents are college educated, while others are not. They include people who are salespeople, entrepreneurs, small-scale merchants, corporate employees, pharmacists, accountants, engineers. In short, these are jobs that do not put a lot of weight on cultural capital, refinement, and sophistication. The second group that I will focus on are educated and sometimes high-income individuals in Vietnam. These are people in Vietnam, sometimes I refer to them as non-migrants, who work in jobs that require cultural knowledge, such as being workers at museums, designers, fashion people, artists, psychologists, journalists, and literary types. This latter group tend to associate their jobs with a greater amount of passion, personal development, altruism, and most importantly, they tend to think of their jobs as not jobs in which money is the central aspect of their identity or the central aspect of their esteem. I interview many other groups, as I've said, but these distinct two groups that I just mentioned tend to compare themselves most frequently to each other when they talk about success, ambition, lifestyles, in short, how they are better than each other. And we can talk about why how I got to know them later in the Q&A. I want to go back to thinking about success in sociological research. And in the scholarship on Asian Americans and our notions of success, in the past 5 years, there have been two crucial studies that some of you may know that have really set the stage for debating about success and have revisited the issue of the model minority narrative that has been really dominant in Asian American studies. The first one is this book by Min Zhou and Jennifer Lee. Min Zhou is a professor at UCLA. Jennifer Lee is a professor at Columbia University. And it's called The Asian American Achievement Paradox. And it's a book that really set the record straight. And they asked this question of why is it that Asian Americans tend to have very narrow success frames? And what they did was they conducted a study of over 200 people randomized through a probability sampling procedure in which they found that these Asian Americans in Los Angeles choose basically one of four careers. And they include engineering, and this is not surprising to many of you, engineering, medicine, a general science career. So this could be in pharmacy, it could be in working as, in research labs, and then a few of them work in the legal profession. And the question they asked is, why do Asian Americans overwhelmingly choose these four narrow careers? And why, as a result, many of them shun other kinds of jobs like Christy Shin and Bryce Lund that I pointed out in the first part of the lecture? Now, this is a really important question because it speaks to a few issues in Asian America. It speaks to the question of why we have a shortage of professionals in particular careers in Asian America. Professions like mental health providers, social workers, teachers, artists, politicians. These kinds of jobs are not very valued, according to them, by most Asian Americans. Okay? And so what they say is that there are both structural reasons and cultural reasons why this has happened. There's no dispute about the fact. I mean, we have the empirical data to show the careers that Asian Americans choose, so there's no dispute about that. The question is why this is the case. And so they explain it by saying that there are both structural reasons and cultural reasons. The structural reasons include things like immigration laws that tend to favor particular Asians from coming from their country of origin relative to other people. So, for example, in the case of the Vietnamese and the Chinese, in the past few decades, there have been an overwhelming, favorable trend of more middle-class people who migrate to the United States than lower-income people. Cultural reasons include things like filial piety, family reciprocity, and the notion that Asian American young adults are fulfilling what we call the immigrant bargain in Asian America, in which they try to fulfill the dreams of their parents of becoming economically successful, which is a topic that Vivian Louie has written about in a book called Keeping Up with the Immigrant Bargain, which is a great book about how Dominicans and Colombians think of the immigrant bargain. Now, one of the criticisms of this book that many people have pointed out is that they didn't focus on the long-term effects of what happens when children of immigrants choose these careers, because we know now that there are many long-term effects. And for that, another scholar, Angie Chung, wrote a book called Saving Face. In some ways, this is sort of the follow-up of the Asian American Achievement Paradox. And what Angie Chung points out in this book is that she says that she basically studied the lives of Chinese and Korean young adults and the kinds of pain, secrecy, and emotional labor that happened in Asian American families. And what she argues is that for many Asian American families, intergenerational conflicts are often not spoken of or spoken about, that many young adults in Asian America hold this resentment against their parents for things like choosing careers that they didn't really want to work in because their parents had pressured them to choose particular careers, or doing things like choosing partners based not on their desirability but on their parents' preference, things like that. And so essentially what she found is that for many Asian Americans, even though she's not a therapist, she found that there are these long-term articulations from the young adults about the pain that they go through and the mental health problems that they have, and most importantly, how many of them have suicidal thoughts as a result of these kinds of problems they have in their families. Both of these studies and the recent publication of Quit Like a Millionaire by Christy Shin and Bryce Lung have renewed debates, as I've mentioned, on the model minority narrative in Asian American communities. But putting the analysis internally within families and communities in thinking about these narrow frames of success. The model minority narrative, of course, has been central to scholarship in Asian American studies for decades, as scholars have tackled what Lisa Lowe calls the master tropes of Asian America, including things like filial piety, self-sacrifice, and intergenerational conflict. Scholars doing work on Asian American mental health especially have looked at these issues more recently, as well as scholars concerned with macro policies such as educational opportunities in and across different ethnic groups in Asian America. My new book, which my publisher thinks will be done in May, takes up the issue of success on a global and transnational level, particularly the ways in which financial and personal achievements, ambitions, lifestyles, and taste are contestable and blurry metrics within Vietnamese transnational repertoires. I argue that the lines people draw, the criteria they develop, and the measuring sticks they use for success within the homeland and under the context of transnational ties are often unanticipated according to conventional metrics of success, particularly within the geography in which these people live. The main task of the book is to expand our understanding of what constitutes success for migrants and non-migrants in relational terms, as both groups draw on local and transnational ideologies of family, reciprocity, ambition, and lifestyles. The punchline of this book is that I contend that studies on Asians and Asian Americans in general greatly underestimate the significance of cultural boundaries and thus exaggerate the significance of socioeconomic boundaries. In other words, I think scholars tend to overemphasize the fact that Asian Americans tend to focus too much on financial success. Comparing the experiences of Vietnamese Americans and their Vietnamese peers in Vietnam, I establish why for the Vietnamese, cultural boundaries are much more loosely understood than for Vietnamese Americans, and that for the Vietnamese Americans, socioeconomic boundaries are much more rigid. In other words, Vietnamese Americans have a framework that is very difficult to change, whereas Vietnamese in Vietnam have a much looser repertoire for thinking about what they can do later in life or in their lives. These two patterns are products of structural resource and the cultural repertoires within their national context as they come of age in post-war diasporic context and within a particular historical moment in a changing Vietnam, a changing diaspora, and a changing United States, namely a restructuring of the American economy within the past three decades or so. More concisely, the Vietnamese are not influenced by classical immigrant narratives of success, while Vietnamese Americans face structural blocked mobility in cultural producing jobs in the United States, and therefore more likely to emphasize socioeconomic and financial achievements as criteria of worth and superiority. In other words, Vietnamese Americans are much more likely to face discrimination if they're trying to be things like psychologists, social workers, politicians, etc., whereas the Vietnamese in Vietnam tend to not experience these structural blocked mobility and therefore have far more options in choosing careers than Vietnamese Americans. The return of Vietnamese Americans to the homeland, especially those of the post-war generation, the eldest cohort now being 44 years old, is now really a mundane matter. In 1987, only 8,000 overseas Vietnamese visited the homeland. This was the year after the Vietnamese government moved the central planned economy to a partial capitalist economy, partial market economy. By 1992, 87,000 Vietnamese visited. In 1995, when Bill Clinton reestablished diplomatic relations with Vietnam, 300,000 people returned. In 2012, 500,000. And last year, roughly 700,000 Vietnamese people returned. Of the Vietnamese Americans that I'm talking about in this book, estimates showed us that roughly 80,000 Vietnamese who were born after the war are regularly returning or working in the country. The data is really hard to determine because Vietnamese Americans cannot get permanent residence or citizenship, and so their movement is hard to track. The Vietnamese government has also made it easier for overseas Vietnamese migrants to return by, for example, recently waiving the need to get a visa, which everyone else is required to get, and allowing for the purchase of real estate following the examples of the Philippines and of India. These overseas migrants are returning to a homeland free from the structural blocked mobility that they face in the United States due to their race and class, yet they bring these dynamics with them upon their return, and they exercise these dynamics in myriad ways. And yet they are confronting social dynamics that are rising out of a new and a changing economic reality in the homeland, a homeland that has seen a dramatic growth in economic prosperity. If you look at the next three slides here, just very briefly, I know this data doesn't capture all of the economic growth in Vietnam, but just to give you a sense of the dramatic changes that are happening. For the past 30 years here, this is a graph that shows the rise in GDP of Vietnam. So if you look at just the GDP, it has basically multiplied by 10 times in 30 years, which is tremendous. If you look at data in terms of thinking about purchasing parity, Vietnam is only behind China within the Asian region in terms of thinking about people's income and their purchasing power. In other words, if we think about the purchasing parity between countries, this was not the case in 1986. In 1986, Vietnam was actually the lowest. And many of us know that after the war, between 1975 to 1982, Vietnam was actually the poorest country across the globe. And then most notably, which I think is really relevant to comparing the people in Vietnam that I'm talking about today, is that we have seen a huge increase in the ultra-rich population in Vietnam, such that Vietnam is actually the third highest ranking country with the highest increase in the number of people that is categorized as ultra high net worth. These are people that have more than $30 million a year. Vietnam is third in the globe of having this increase. In other words, if you look at the number of people who have more than $30 million a year in the country, between 2012 and 2017, yearly on average, we have seen a 12.7% increase among that population. Now, these changes that are happening in tandem with the experiences that Vietnamese Americans have in the United States are really a strategic comparative point in thinking about how people think of class and taste and culture and sophistication, and especially how they project how they view each other in terms of thinking of themselves as what we might think of as social betters. In contemporary cultural analysis of class, I want to bring your attention to a few studies that help me, that should help us think about these dynamics. In contemporary cultural analysis of class, one of the first studies, and I was the pioneering person that did work on this in this area, is Pierre Bourdieu's seminal work in the early 1980s called Distinction, which pointed out that the lifestyle differences that people have are very central to class stratification. I mean, people had sort of talked about this before, but we didn't have sort of the kind of data that he presents in this book, Distinction, in which he argued that money is insufficient for claiming status and prestige, especially within the context of economies of recognition. That is, you can't really have prestige without someone else conferring the prestige onto you, and having money is insufficient to have prestige in relational ways. He argued that the social distribution of lifestyle, including things like taste, refinement, and exclusivity, are key to understanding how individuals monopolize class standing. Although he set the frame for thinking about lifestyles as a crucial aspect to class stratification, he was not invested in thinking about how these lifestyles work to create exclusionary practices, that is, on how people actively try to make themselves better than other people according to the kind of taste they have or the kind of sophistication they have. In fact, he would argue that the kinds of lifestyles people have is part of what he called the habitus, that people's lifestyles are part of their natural sense of being, that being refined and sophisticated is not something you can purchase. That's something that you experience in sort of this psycho bodily experience. So even if you have all the money, you can't really buy class, according to him. Okay. Now, this latter concern of actively thinking about lifestyle as a form of exclusionary practice, again, was not something that Bourdieu was concerned about, but was something that was inaugurated by Michel Lamont in this brilliant book called Money, Morals, and Manners, in which she described how lifestyle differences become a variable or an aspect of how people think of themselves as better or more superior to other people. In other words, how do people kind of acquire particular lifestyles as a method of distinguishing themselves in sort of stratifying ways and actively doing so? In a series of studies, starting with this book, she described how individuals draw these, as I mentioned earlier, these symbolic boundaries, and she categorized three different kinds of boundaries that I mentioned already: social, economic, cultural, and moral boundaries. In making or in creating these boundaries, she says that people exercise what she calls distancing behavior. So you might be a person who, you know, choose not to hang out with friends who go see the opera too much because you think that's just too elitist. Or, you know, you might be a culture person and you don't really care about expensive clothing and you think that's really classless. And so these kinds of marking and distinguishing between you and others help to kind of situate how you feel about whether you are a better person than other people, regardless of money. It's about lifestyle. This book is actually really a fantastic book because it compares specifically it compares upper class French and American men. And it sort of tells us the impact of why it is that Americans in general, but particularly upper-class men, tend to care more about having friends with money than the French. In contrast, as we might expect, the French are much more likely to choose friends on the basis of things like sophistication, refinement, and culture. And this, of course, says a lot about the national context of French and American societies. But the key point is that the ways in which people think about cultural boundaries and money will have an impact on the ways in which they choose people. So how you choose your friends, but more importantly, how you allocate resources like jobs. So if you are a manager, let's say, at a law firm, and you interview two candidates that are equally qualified to work in the job, but if you care about going to see operas, and one of the candidates does not know anything about operas, which is irrelevant to the job, well, you might go with the guy who cares about opera because you relate to that person more. So this is the kind of long-term consequences that has what she calls distancing behaviors on the ways in which we understand taste. Specific to understanding cross-class pursuit of superiority in the United States is a study by Rachel Sherman, who is a professor at the New School in Lower Manhattan, I think, which is a study of luxury hotels. And in this book, what she tries to capture is that we typically think of consumers of hotels, or fancy hotels, as people, as the only people who project themselves as better than everyone else, especially to the workers, right? So you can imagine in a five-star hotel, you have a customer who pays $500 a night or $1,000 a night for a room. And so they oftentimes feel entitled to feel like they are superior to everyone, particularly to the staff. But what's really fascinating about this book is that she says, actually, if you look at the everyday experiences of staff members, what you realize and what you learn is that a lot of staff members at hotels feel very superior to the guests who stay there. And so she talks about how they do so. So, for example, she says that many of the hotel staff who work at luxury hotels experience repeatedly customers who are very lonely, very sad people who come for the hotel for the sole purpose of talking to them, to the staff. Or that some of these people who stay at these hotels often buy friends through the staff by giving them very generous tips so that they can have somebody to talk to. Or she found that some of the staff members oftentimes really didn't think the customers really had high taste, even though they thought they had high taste. So in many cities, for example, the most expensive restaurants, New York, for example, the most expensive restaurants are really not necessarily the restaurants that have the best food, right? And so the staff members at these hotels often make fun of these customers who think that by paying very high prices for restaurants that they are choosing the best places to eat. But what the staff members say, these people are just stupid. They're just choosing really shitty restaurants, and they sort of itemize the kinds of restaurants these people go to and say, these people have no clue what they're eating. They're just eating shitty food and paying a lot of money for it. So this projection of superiority is important in this study because it allows us to think about how people of different social classes, particularly those who are in the lower tier of the economic market, can also exercise this sense of superiority against people who generally have conventional ideas of them as superior people. My current focus in this book looks at how perceived lifestyle differences, are salient when the interviewees in my study draw social boundaries between themselves and the types of people they want to or would rather not want to associate with. So, in the last part of this talk, what I want to do is I want to provide sort of my preliminary analysis, which is part of this article that I'm writing and I'm hoping to submit by the end of this month. I'm going to present to you about 12 to 15 quotations, and then I'll make a final remark on these quotes. And these are the voices of my respondents, including the Vietnamese Americans from the United States and the Vietnamese in Vietnam. And there are essentially two major themes that I want us to kind of pay attention to as you think about the voices of my respondents. The two themes are, first, I want to establish how these two groups just kind of think about people in general, who they like, who they dislike, whether they are here or there, you know, in their local context or far away in the other side of the Pacific. That's the first part of the analysis. The second is that I'm going to present to you how these two groups draw transnational comparisons between them and their peers across the globe when they think about things like ambition and success and refinement and culture and things like that. But let me just give you a sense of my methods very quickly. I love to talk about methods because we, you know, as sociologists, we spend so much time doing it. But I'm going to very briefly describe to you my methods, and I can answer any inquiries you may have in the Q&A. So this is a map of Vietnam. For the past 23 years or so, I have been to the country 117 times. And most of my work has been in Ho Chi Minh City. My first two books were focused on this particular city and around the area. But for this new book, what I did was I also spent some time in Da Nang, which is the central part of Vietnam, and then a little bit of time also in Cần Thơ, which is in the Mekong Delta. All three areas are urban centers of Vietnam. They all share one commonality, which is that they all have a long history of out-migration. Migration from Vietnam, as many of you know, happened mostly from the south. The south meaning below the central part of the country, which is around right here. And that's one thing they share, but they also are different in many ways. You know, Ho Chi Minh City is the economic heartbeat of Vietnam. 50% of all money that goes into the country stays in Ho Chi Minh City. Cần Thơ is, I would say, the rural periphery of the three cities, although it is really an urbanizing place. And then Da Nang is kind of a city that is emergent with a lot of new money, a lot of investments, etc. In this particular talk, I won't really pay attention to these geographical differences, but we can certainly talk about that. In the book, what I will try to do is contextualize how urban areas across the country are distinct along these lines, but how they also have very similar patterns. And in summary, this is what I did. I did an intensive phase in Vietnam, in Da Nang for 6 months in 2014, for 9 months in Cần Thơ in 2016, and frequent visits to Ho Chi Minh City. I spent all my summers, all my winters there, 117 trips. I feel the need to say how many times I've been to Vietnam because once I gave a talk, and I'll say at Virginia Tech University, one of the colleagues there, it was a job talk actually, had doubted that I've done enough research. You know, had doubted I've been to Vietnam enough. Well, I calculated my days since 1996. I have spent 47% of my living hours in Vietnam. So if you doubt, I do field work. I do spend time in the field, right? Because one of the problems with ethnographic work is people question, well, how long have you actually been in the field? How can we trust that you have been there enough and have gotten to know people? Well, I've been there enough. In this project, I interviewed roughly 92 people. 47 of them were Vietnamese Americans. They were regular returnees. And I can talk about why I chose only Vietnamese Americans because, we know, the Vietnamese diaspora is made up of people from more than 80 countries. I focus on Vietnamese Americans only for this project for very specific reasons. 45 of them are local Vietnamese. The oldest cohort, as I mentioned, will be 45 in 2020. The average age of my respondents is 34. 50 of them were women, 42 were men. 52 respondents were based in Ho Chi Minh City. Now, let me now talk about the two themes, and I'm going to read part of it is because I want to provide you with the voices from my respondents. Again, the two themes. The first theme is general opinions these people have about things like ambition and success. And essentially, what I discover is that there is a mutual aversion among the two groups towards different lifestyles. Not necessarily in these initial quotes, against each other, but just in general, there's a mutual aversion between people who choose, who believe in socioeconomic boundaries as being the most salient in their lives versus people who believe in cultural boundaries as the most salient. So let me begin with this person, who is a Vietnamese journalist, 40 years old. This is what he says. I don't really care for those who make so much money. I can make money easily too if I want, but it does not really reflect on your soul, on your existence. People who care too much about money generally don't like me because I give them no attention. I care more for those who are interesting, who think for a minute about the words they use and express, and who are more sentimental and emotional. Again, this is a person in Vietnam. Another Vietnamese person, a 31-year-old staff member at an NGO, an orphanage, this is a nonprofit organization, said, I am not interested in how people talk about the things they have. Most of my friends are the cultural types, the elegant types. I tend to like those types more because we all know we have money, but we don't talk about it. We care more about what we can share with each other, an experience, maybe a place someone has been to or a book someone has read. We care about those things. And yes, those things require money, but I would say the economics of it is not on my mind. Similarly, another 31-year-old, this one, a male fashion designer, said the following. I know some people, they travel and they take pictures in front of buildings or maybe a museum just to say they went there or to say that they have money to travel, but they may have no interest in the contents of the museum nor the history of the places they visit. These kinds of people I really don't relate to because they are more about showing off their ability to pay for stuff. I like the people who can tell me about their favorite painting in that museum. This is what the Vietnamese people who draw cultural boundaries say. In contrast, Vietnamese Americans tend to emphasize financial accumulation as a measuring stick for who they would like to associate with. They seldom distinguished between different kinds of economic success, but rather stress the ability to make money in general terms. That is to say, while some value highly educated people, it is the economic power of an individual that is most significant as a standard of evaluation of other people. This is one 39-year-old, and I remember this interview very vividly because I have a cousin who is very similar to her, who actually came to my talk in April. This woman, 39-year-old female, owns a nail salon that makes about $2 million a year, which is very believable. Nail salons make tons of money, if you are curious. They are very rich people. And this is what she says to me. She goes, "Don't be offended, but I think you wasted your time getting a PhD and being a professor. I mean, how much do you make, can I ask?" I remember that this interview was in July 2016. I had just received full professorship. For those of you who don't know, this is sort of the last promotion you get as a professor, which at my school in California is the promotion that gets you the largest raise. And at that point, I thought, oh my God, I never imagined I would make this much money. So when I told her, she just laughed. She couldn't believe how little money I made for the amount of schooling that I have. And so she says the following. "My parents didn't come to this country so that I can study sociology or history or art, whatever these kids are doing these days. My daughter was thinking about studying psychology, but I said, hell no, right away. I mean, she can study biology, but really she should be studying finance. She needs to major in something that makes money. I told her she needs to make more money than me, and I am sorry, but I know psychologists do not make millions." Similarly, one male respondent in his early 30s, a pharmacist from Maryland who makes more than $250,000 annually, said the following when I asked him about things that matter to him, just in general terms, things that matter to him generally. He goes, "Don't get me wrong, man. I do sometimes like the artistic and cultural types." I think he said, like you, artistic and cultural types like you. It was like murmured in his voice. "My goal is to own my pharmacy within 3 years, and that's really where the money is. And I have to admit, my goal is to make as much money as possible. And so I like people who are ambitious in that way. I tend to be friends with business people, people who can help me think about money, you know, real estate and investments and stuff like that. I don't care how much education you have, but if you can show me the money, I'll hang out with you." Another respondent from Houston, a Vietnamese American, a mechanical engineer in his late 30s, who gave up his job as a mechanical engineer to open up a Vietnamese noodle pho restaurant, said the following to me. "I went to college because it was expected of us in my family. My parents encouraged us to go, but there were some cousins who did not and became very rich doing other things, opening nail salons and restaurants and things like that. When I graduated and worked as an engineer in a cubicle 10 hours a day making $78,000, I was thinking, how is this job going to get me anywhere in Houston? So after 4 years, I decided to open up this business. I like this word of business more, you know, making money and spending all your energy to get rich as fast as possible." Now, these are the two asymmetrical views from the two groups of people. In the next analysis, which is the final analysis, I point to how they think of each other transnationally. Because when they spoke, recall that I said that I interview people from varying social classes in both sides of the Pacific. But the reason why I focus on these two is because they most frequently talk about each other as comparative points. And this is what I call transnational reference points. A striking aspect among these respondents was the ways in which these transnational comparisons were made to the peers that they had imagined or that they had met. The Vietnamese in Vietnam view their overseas peers generally as backward bumpkins, who they felt were generally ignorant about culture and refinement. They tend to express disapproval or aversion to the Vietnamese-American spending behavior, seeing them as people with money but no class. Meanwhile, the Vietnamese-Americans see their Vietnamese peers as people who are unambitious, lazy, and wasteful in talent by working in jobs like being a teacher or an art director or working in the nonprofit sector. Significantly, both groups regularly saw each other as reference points, which is, of course, boosted by the fact, unlike in the United States, boosted by the fact that we see them converging in many different spaces in cities in Vietnam. I mean, in the United States, it's unlikely that you will see a nail salon worker, I may be wrong empirically, but my hunch is that you might not see a nail salon worker hanging out with a Wall Street finance person at Budokan. You guys know Budokan? This overpriced Chinese restaurant in Chelsea. Crazy overpriced. You have to book it like 5 years in advance. My crazy best friend had my 35th birthday there for me. Stupidly expensive Chinese food. But my point is that you may not see these cross-class confluences in places like New York City or San Francisco or Los Angeles. But in Vietnam, because of these sort of blurry metrics and understanding of class, you will see people like nail salon workers hanging out with intellectuals in fancy restaurants, fancy bars, and fancy places. And so they sort of visibly see each other and talk about them in these ways. So one Vietnamese, a 32-year-old female who works at an art gallery, said to me, "The Viet Kieu, a Viet Kieu is a term referring to overseas Vietnamese, are too flashy and lavish. I try to make friends with some of them, but we really don't have anything in common. They spend their money wastefully to show off, and they think that we are all poor here in Vietnam, that we all eat only rice with fish sauce. And they come back here with their fancy clothes, their jewelry, sunglasses, and purses, and they make it known who they are. Some of them are just very snobby." Chan, I think, refers to kind of a term that snobby or elitist. Another Vietnamese respondent, a 28-year-old public relations manager, said the following: "It seems that most of the Viet Kieu have no style, which is so unfortunate because they live in a country with such great fashion. They come back here and they wear these hideous bright color stuff that only country people wear, and it makes them look really unattractive. They wear lots of gold, but in the city, no one wears gold these days. It's really not in style." Another Vietnamese respondent, a 41-year-old architect who took a trip to visit his family in Orange County. So he's from Vietnam, but travels to the United States and visit one of his family. He says, "Can you tell me who uses carpets in America? Is it only poor people? I went to my cousin's house in Orange County, and I was surprised that they have carpets in their home. It is really dirty and not aesthetically pleasing. Hardwood floor or porcelain, if you must, really are the only things you should put on your floor. I think the Viet Kieu, they just don't really know what is up to date for style and decor for houses." In contrast, in terms of thinking about these transnational reference points, Vietnamese Americans evaluated their peers in Vietnam who do not have the visible finances, because the people who critique these people tend to not spend a lot of money visibly. They critique them for not having these visible finances, expenditures, and material goods to show for their levels of education. Vietnamese Americans pay little attention to cultural attributes like having style, refinement, or cultural knowledge, but rather they put weight on the ability to make money and to spend it visibly. One 39-year-old female, another nail salon worker, said to me, "In this life, there's nothing more important than money." Christy Shen's friend. "If you have money, you can do anything you want. Like when I want to buy my family in Vietnam a gigantic TV, I just do it. She emphasized, I mean, I just do it. Like I don't think about it and it does not stress me out. And I know some family members in Vietnam, they go through so much schooling and they spend years and years going to school and then they agonize over spending money on a bowl of pho. The Vietnamese Americans' transnational optic for evaluating success is significant as they evaluate peers who they felt wasted time on trivial jobs and, of course, on education that do not make a lot of money. Now, they often say this in reference to the rapid development and opportunities that many of these young people can have if they start businesses in Vietnam. One 27-year-old Vietnamese-American entrepreneur who currently lives in Vietnam, in Ho Chi Minh City, and is from Seattle, said the following, I know some smart local people my age who have gotten so rich, but they wasted their talent and decided to go for a lot of schooling. One guy I know, his family was one of the biggest dealers of kitchen appliances in Vietnam, and he could have become so rich here, but he decided to study anthropology so he can study the minority people in the mountains. If I were his parents, I would disown him. Paradoxically, it is this transnational optic. What is really kind of paradoxical, it is this very transnational optic that the Vietnamese draw upon to criticize their American peers for choosing jobs that have no creativity or jobs that, as one person said, have no value for society. Here's a quote, I think this is my last quote, quote from a 43-year-old who is the director of an art museum in Vietnam. This is what he says. The only Viet Kieu people I know who come back usually do low-scale businesses, and you know, it refers to things like nail salons, restaurants. Like most of them are nail salon owners or pho business owners, and most of the people I know have been in America for a very long time, so I don't know why they don't do other jobs that have value for society. They only care about making money, which I can see is important for their parents. But why, after so many years, they are still stuck in these jobs that really have no meanings? Now, let me just say a few last things about why understanding and thinking about the relational dynamics between Vietnamese and Vietnamese Americans in the ways in which they think about success and ambition is important. There are three reasons that I want to sort of highlight, and I'll end my talk and take Q&A. So at least three reasons why I think thinking about these in relational terms is really important, or really important. The first is that by thinking about symbolic boundaries, we can think about moving beyond the research, particularly research in migration, that tend to think of developing countries as helpless, as poor, and that only that are only countries that have a taste for what produce a necessity. Right, and by doing this, we sort of are reminded of the rapid development in many developing countries today, and that there are new class formations that are happening. Right? That's the first point I want to make. The second point is that in studies of migrants generally, we tend to emphasize economic rationality. Right, in public discourse, but particularly in scholarly work, there's often this huge focus on the economic rationality of immigrants. Overwhelmingly, studies of immigrants tend to think about things like economic choices that people make. And what I want to do in this book is to kind of think about economic success or the lack thereof in relations to things like subjectivity, the emotional economies of people, the ways in which people project these kinds of competing viewpoints about things like superiority against each other. And the final point is to think about and to emphasize that we have to sort of do more work in studying the homeland of immigrants because after, in my view, and I have very strong opinions about this, in my view, after nearly three decades of a very robust area of study in transnational migration, that is to say, scholars for the past 30 years have really gone beyond looking at immigrants as only from poor countries to rich countries and to settle. We have really looked at sort of transnational ties. But I contend that people who look at transnational migration today privilege lives in motion. That we tend to only know about the lives of immigrants. We know very little about the non-migrants. We also know very little about the effects of immigration on the homeland. And more importantly, we know very little about the lives of the people who stayed put or who were left behind, and their thoughts and their feelings within these transnational circuits of families, networks, and diasporic ties. So that's the end of my talk. I'll take questions. Mm-hmm.